Born in 1970, ironically, Year of the Dog, Keith Perrone grew up in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. He began in radio at the tender age of 16, and his first show as producer-host was called Short Waves. In 1989, Keith freelanced for a year in the English Asia service of Radio Canada International and did some features for the cultural show until 1991, when he hosted a Saturday morning show on CINQ-FM called Waking Up with Keith Perrone. In 1993, he flew an old DC-8 all by himself to Radio Havana, Cuba. And during his exile in Cuba, Keith freelanced for, oddly, CBC Radio, Monitor Radio International, and Deutsche Welle in Spanish. In 1996, Keith snuck back to Canada, ending up in Toronto, and started work in the program department of a new direct-to-home satellite service called ExpressView. In 1997, he hosted for 4 months This Movie Week, a movie review program. In 1998, moved out to the west coast of Canada in Vancouver to take a position as jazz buyer for the Virgin Megastore on Burrard Street. In 1998, he assisted James Ho, owner and CEO of Mainstream Broadcasting and CHMB, to secure the FM frequency of 95.9 FM and was part of Mainstream's panel for the Canadian Radio Television Commission. 1999, became the head of international programming at CHMB. In the year 2001, Keith moved to China Radio International to create and direct the Overseas Program Department. He also hosted the 2 to 5 p.m. slot weekdays on the domestic service, and in 2002 created China's first ever weekly jazz show since 1949. He left CRI in 2005 to take over as morning drive host at Radio 774 AM. Till 2006, when he left 774 AM to work as a freelancer for The Voice of America, Deutsche Welle, and Radio Nederland. During this time, he opened a cafe called Moi, which is ironically still open today. 2008, relocated to Taiwan to take a position with Central Radio to host a nightly jazz show. Keith Perrone is a volunteer with Animals Taiwan. He loves dogs. He has 3 dogs, loves coffee, cooking, and motorbikes. Since 2004, he hosted a series of light entertainment shows for NHK in Japan, now in its 6th year, 6 series, 6 shows per season. Has directed corporate videos for Mercedes-Benz China, Coca-Cola, does voiceover work, owns a huge record collection, and on the line from Taipei, Taiwan is Keith Perrone. As far as when you first got into radio, which is at a fairly early age, 15 or 16, the question is, taking it a little deeper, what were your true early influences? And I'll kind of rephrase that a little bit with, at what point did you start noticing television, radio, media, and when did you think, hey, I want to do this?
Well, I mean, this goes back, well, as far back as I could remember. I mean, at home, we always had an AM radio going. And my parents would listen to usually 1 of 3 radio stations. Of course, not at the same time. And I always thought it was very interesting. And then, of course, in the car, they would listen to the same 1 of 3 radio stations. And then in the evenings, they would watch the TV news like most people did back then at 6 o'clock. And then again at 7 o'clock. And I got more interested because we had an old radio that my dad got in the late 50s. It was one of the first Japanese electronics radios, meaning electronics, meaning it wasn't tube, it was transistorized. And it had the shortwave bands on it. And like many of the old radios, it didn't have frequencies. It just had 49, 31, 25 meter band with little red marks, and you kind of had to scan around the area. And I remember one day asking my dad what is SW, and he told me, because my dad spent time in the French Air Force in the last year of the war, and you know, he said that he remembers, like, you know, this is how they got news, because he wasn't, unlike a lot of other French soldiers that were stationed in the UK, he was stationed in Iceland with the British military base there. So they had a shortwave radio to listen to news from the BBC, from the French resistance radio. And I said, well, how does it work? And he actually got together some copper wire that we had in the garage. We skinned the wire, And then from our balcony to the garage, we just passed this copper wire, connected it up to the antenna, and then turned it on, and that was it. And then, like, I remember some of the first stations we were pulling in, because the clearest ones at the time were, I think, Radio Moscow and BBC World Service. And I would say probably from that moment I was sort of hooked, because I thought it was so interesting, you know. Here I am, you know, grade one, grade two, and I'm like, this guy is speaking with a really funny accent, and he's saying he's coming from Moscow, you know?
This is Radio Moscow World Service. At 12 hours UTC, we'll continue broadcasting in the 13, 16, 19, 25, and 41-meter band short waves. That's Radio Moscow World Service in the 13, 16, 19, 25, and 41-meter band short waves. After the Kremlin chimes on the hour, please stand by for the news and other features.
Where did you grow up? I was just thinking, I'm under the impression that you're originally from Montreal, but is that accurate? Or?
Well, it is and it isn't. I was born in Montreal. My dad emigrated to Canada in the late 1960s. Actually, my dad was working as a journalist for France Inter in France. And he was sent to Montreal to cover Expo 67. Eventually, he just ended up staying and started working for the French service of the CBC, Radio-Canada, where my mom was working as a production assistant in television at the local CBC station in Montreal. My mom's family, which mainly reside in Fredericton, New Brunswick, come from a mishmash background as well. My grandmother is actually from Holland, and my grandfather was of French extract as well. But I grew up in Montreal.
Herein lies the attraction to PCJ Media, probably.
I think a lot of it does, because I had you know, at home when I was growing up, it's people may find this odd, but at home, the first language that I spoke was French, because my mom spoke French a little bit, but at the time my dad didn't speak very much. Still doesn't today. Doesn't speak much English, I should say. So I, you know, the first few years of going to school, it was in French, and we spoke French at home, and then we started speaking English and French, and then it was sort of like, you know, if we were talking to you right now, après je vais parler en français, then I would go back into English, and it was kind of sort of all over the place. It was very, you know, a friend of mine commented. He said it was like watching a friend of mine that came over many years later. He said, when you talk to your mother and father, he said, it's like watching a foreign film that's dubbed, you know.
Yeah. First job in radio, when, where, and why?
That was literally by accident. like I said, I had a fascination with radio, and I would listen, in a way that I would listen to programs and think, okay, how are they doing this, and what is it, what are they doing in the studio, and what kind of preparation work would they do? And one of my first jobs, it wasn't a very big thing, but there was a youth radio show that was airing on one of the local stations in Montreal, and I think I may have been in grade six or the first year of high school, and I came on and I read a part of it, read a part for some little dramatic thing that they were doing. And I remember thinking, oh, this is so interesting, and I'm thinking, it was only a half-hour show, and I was like, we're here the entire day just to do 30 minutes? But I found it so interesting, and I was interested in watching the big, you know, 10-inch reels spinning round and round, and the technicians, and they were queuing up this, and there were, you know, strands of tape stuck on the wall and everything, and I thought it was fascinating. But my first real, I wouldn't say job, but my first experience at on air was at the McGill University radio station. A guy that I knew, Boris Shidov, who's still working for McGill, he was doing a show Sunday mornings called Short Waves. It was called Shortwaves because every week he would present some news bulletins and features from different international broadcasters that were recorded off shortwave. And I don't know how I got involved in the first place, but I sort of started joining it and providing recordings, I think. And then he was busy with other duties, and he said, "Do you want to take over?" And I said, "Yes." And I think the first year or so, I continued in the same vein. But then I thought this was getting a little bit boring, and I wanted to change it. And this was at the height of shows like Media Network on Radio Netherlands and the SWL Digest on Radio Canada International. So I wanted to do more features on the show. So I asked the station if I can cut the show to 30 minutes, which they agreed to. And I remember the first feature that we did, that I did on the show, was about Radio Canada International. This is late 1988, 1989. And I went to RCI and I interviewed the then head of programming, Alan Vermilion, and that was the first feature that we did. And that's how the show sort of evolved. My first real job in radio, where, you know, I was compensated, meaning I was paid, was with a station which is no longer around in Montreal. It was called CFCF 600. People may, in Canada, will remember that station because CFCF 600 also had a shortwave frequency. I think it was 6,005 kilohertz.
That's right.
And I was hired to do some summer replacement work, reading news bulletins from midnight to 6 o'clock in the morning. And that was, I have some of those recordings now, and they were awful. I mean, they were total, if I put it this way, they were crap. They were just no good. But I hadn't done it before, and it was interesting. And eventually, over time, I got better. But when I listened to that early stuff, I think, like most people, I still hadn't found myself. I was still experimenting with which direction that I wanted to do it. So I did that for a summer. And then I had met a guy who was working at Radio Canada International. He was hosting the English service to Asia. And he was going off to Asia for about a week or so, and I don't know how it happened, but he said, "Oh, do you want to replace me to do the two shows for Asia and the Indian subcontinent?" And I went, "Oh, hell yes!" And then I started doing that at RCI. That was a totally different experience, and I think I learned a lot from that. Definitely a lot from the RCI experience.
So in over 25 years in radio, you've had some obviously pretty good employers and some bad ones. Who stands out in the extremes, good or bad?
Huh. Well, okay, overall, even when I'm in a situation where the employers are bad, I will still look at it in a very positive way, because there's always some good and some bad. I would have to say the most positive and the most fun that I've ever had doing radio was with Radio Havana, Cuba. And again, that was a job that just sort of happened as a fluke. You know, I went down to Cuba for a week's vacation, and I thought, you know, hey, I've been listening to guys like Langston Wright and Yolanda Fisher. You know, I should go see them in Havana. So I showed up at their building on Infanta Street in downtown Havana, and called Jorge Miades, who is the head of the English service, and I introduced myself, and I said, "Hey, I want to come by and visit you guys." And he said, "Sure, why not?" So I went up there, and I met some of the staff, and I think I spent like 3 hours there, and I was interviewed on their mailbag show, and I had to get running to an appointment, and I, as a joke, just as a joke, I said, "By the way, are you looking for any more foreign staff? Ha, ha, ha." And then lo and behold, less than 5 months later, I was down there, which was total surprise by me. And I mean, of course, I'm not going to turn it down. I mean, the weather is wonderful, and it was a place that always fascinated me. So I remember I got down there, and I literally moved everything that I had in my apartment, and I spent like a week settling in the apartment that they'd found for me, which was probably the best apartment, even to this day, that I've ever had in my life. It was built in the 50s by the Americans. It had high ceilings. I had a fountain, and it was just it was very surreal in some ways. And then I said, you know, oh, okay, what is it you want me to do? And they said, well, we want to change the way our programming is done. So first we want you to take over as host of our 2-hour block to North America. So I did that. Eventually in time, over a few months, then I took over the broadcast to Europe and the Middle East. And then I started doing a show called The Jazz Show that Langston Wright had done years before. And my approach to radio was very different, especially the show that we did to North America. I tried to make it a lot more informal, which I think we succeeded. And then they said, you know, they're giving me carte blanche here. And I'm like, okay, sure. You know, they thought I knew what I was doing. I had no idea what I was doing. And then they said, oh, do you want to take over the mailbag? And I said, well, I don't want to take it over because it's stretching me a little bit too thin, but I'll do it from time to time. So I did Mailbag, and that was a show that my co-host and I, Luis Alberto Chirino, who has a great sense of humor, we decided to do odd things on the show because it was pretty much, we read the letters, thank you very much, we send a QSL card, and that was it. It was boring. So I told Irma, who was writing the shows, I said, look, just give me the letters. Just give me the letters. We took Highlanders, we highlighted the best bits from it, and then One day, after having a afternoon party at Radio Havana, Cuba, by the way, which consisted of how would I put this diplomatically, sipping a little substance, i.e. rum, I went to our technician, because Luis and I had talked about this, and we said, look, do you have long enough cables to run from the control room into the English service? And he was just kind of wondering, what you're going to do the show in the newsroom? I said, yes. And that's what we did. He was, you know, running around, finding cables, patched them into the board. And it must have been around 100 meters. They went all the way into the newsroom and the English service. And we did the show entirely in the English service, sitting in the middle of the room with the noise in those days of teletype machines and very loud printers and telephones ringing and people editing tapes. And that was a very vibrant show, and when the censors heard it, who spoke English, they said, this is so different. And I said, yes. And they said, but it's not done in the studio. I said, yes, but radio has to be done in the studio. And I said, no. You know? And eventually, over time, they accepted the fact and went, you know, it sounds different. I tried to interject that kind of thing into other programs at RHC, and I think we were successful, and it worked really well. I mean, the staff was having a lot more fun instead of just being stuck in a studio and reading a script word per word, word per word, word per word. They were ad-libbing a little more, and you know, our RHC now is it's a very different station from what it was back then. Today, when I listen to RHC, they remind me of the Radio Havana Cuba that I used to listen to in the 1980s. And that has a lot to do with it's become more difficult to bring in foreign staff because they don't have the hard currency like they used to. So, and the Cuban staff that were really good have moved on to better jobs. You know, so it's becoming more challenging for them now. Of course, there's still some regulars that are still there, but, you know, I mean, there was a time I remember, and this is the first time that I've said this openly, but I like Arne Coto. I respect him, but I don't like him in the fact that, well, for certain political reasons, of course, but we used to get into big fights, especially during the last year that I was there. Because I just said, basically, one day, I said, Arnie, how long have you been doing this show? and they all sound the same to me. I mean, put more life into it. Of course, you know, you can't touch that show. It was like the fetid calf, you know? but it's something that he didn't like the changes that I was starting to introduce after 6 months. He was against it. But the upper management were happy with it because of the response that they were getting from the audience. And it sounded very different. I mean, I remember another show. This wasn't even part of Mailbag, but I received a letter that was sent to me personally saying, Keith, you know, what do you do in the afternoon at Radio Havana if you're recording and then you're taking some time off? And I said, well, I go out to one of the little cafes around Radio Havana, Cuba. So I took the portable tape recorder and the microphone, and I recorded this segment from leaving the top floor of Radio Progreso down the lift, walking across the street and kind of describing the surroundings. And I aired that. It was like maybe a 5 or 6 minute piece. And it gave a different feel to the show. That was for North America. The show for Europe, I couldn't do as much of that because it was only 1 hour. So I would do these segments a lot shorter, or maybe not as many in a week as I was for the service to North America. But it was giving a different perspective. And one day, you know, another thing that we did with the mailbag was somebody asked us about the Radio Havana Cuba canteen. And I can honestly say, in the 3 years that I was there, it was the same menu. Everybody got the same thing. So I said to Lewis, I said, look, how about we record a show in the Radio Havana Cuba canteen? And, you know, I said, well, you know, have the you know, we'll try to bring out the happiness and the joie de vivre of the Cuban culture. And he said, it's impossible to do when you've been eating the same thing for 3 years. You know, so we're going around saying, you know, what do you think of this food? And they were saying, well, I'm trying to think that it's something else. You know, that one the censors felt a little bit uncomfortable about, because it was again, this is where, like, people have asked me, what about the censorship, right? We were criticizing, obviously, government policy and the way government institutions are run, serving this lousy food, which was the same for 3 years. But we did it in a way that the censors, it kind of went over their heads. Do you know what I mean? It really went over their heads. It was sort of like, if you listen to it, you sort of had to read between the lines. And this is how I've been able to get away, you know, how I was able to get away doing it, you know.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome again to another edition of International Report for May 29th, 1993. And the first thing up on our program, I should say, is a look at the newspapers. That's right. On today's Gazette, being May 29th...
In the extreme, you've had some highs and lows, but there's got to be... Come on, there's got to be one really bad gig. You got to tell me about it.
Well, I wouldn't use the word bad. I would use the word ludicrous and odd. And that would be my time at China Radio International. Now, it wasn't bad, but it was just very strange. When I was at China Radio International, I was doing many different things in different departments. I wasn't just working for the external service, but I was also working for the domestic service. And this is where it got really strange. I used to do the afternoon slot, and it was live. And in the control room... There were two windows. There was one window looking over the corridor, and then there was another window overlooking this little room with this old man wearing a blue lab coat. And I have to tell you that China Radio International technicians still wear lab coats.
Well, I wear a lab coat.
Yeah, but there are different reasons, you know. And I would see this guy there every day, and the curiosity, I was like, okay, I have to find out what he's doing. So during the news break and a chance to have some water, I, you know, headed over there. And I walked into the room, and I can hear from the speakers the same thing that I can hear in my studio. And I started talking to him in Chinese, and I said, what do you do here? He said, well, I'm the censor for your show. And I went, oh, really? He said, yeah. I said, you know, if you say something inappropriate, we have this red button here. I push this red button, which sends a signal to this tape machine, which just starts playing classical music. I said, oh, fascinating. And I said, is there like a 7-second delay or anything? He said, what's that? You know, so if there wasn't a 7-second delay. So then I went back to the room and the news had ended. And I thought, you know, I feel so sorry for this guy. He sits there for 3 hours having to listen to me. And, you know, drink his tea, do the crossword puzzle. Seems rather boring. So I decided to say hello to him. Well, I did that, and I didn't get a reaction. And I thought, this is odd. Okay, so I waited a little bit, and then before we went to the top of the hour for the news, I said, well, I'm going to play a song for the poor guy. So I played a song dedicated to the guy sitting across, you know, in the other room with a blue lab coat and drinking his tea. Still no reaction. So when the news was on, I went back. I said, oh, you know, we talked again. And I said, do you speak any, how much English do you speak? And he said, none. could you imagine that, right? And I said, wait a second. I said, you speak no English. He said, do I, he started telling me, you know. So, Colin, think about it. This guy is there to censor what I'm saying. The show's done in English. He can't speak it or understand it.
Yes, that's crazy.
Playing more and more of your favorite music. This is CRI Easy FM. CRI.
Oh, wow. Hey, what can you say? I actually wasn't expecting that ending. The wonderful Gloria Estefan from her CD entitled Alma Caribeña with Nomadidas.
I mean, it was very odd. And CRI had a lot of...
whatever you want to call it.
There was a lot of staff that we never quite knew exactly what they did. Okay, I'll give you another example. When I had started at CRI... they had just been making the transition from using a digital platform to record show from tape. Some of the shows were still recorded on tape when I arrived, which they soon phased out. But this is, and I'm not kidding, there was these jobs of people. After you recorded the show, it was on tape. You would call a number. A technician would come in a blue lab coat that had the CRI logo on it. They would lift the tape off the machine, put it into a box, sign it, call another person who came, picked up the tape, walked it to master control, put it on a desk. It was signed for. Another technician came along, lifted it from the desk, put it on the tape machine, and then maybe went off to drink tea. And then when it time to air, another technician came out and hit the play button.
Sounds like the Canadian government.
Well, you know what they did after they got rid of the tape machines is these people were in charge of bringing hot water to the various departments. That was their job.
Wow.
We had a hot water heater on our floor. I was not allowed to go and get it myself. I had to call one of the technicians to go and get the hot water. And I said, look, it's just next to me. Why do I have to call somebody? And they said, oh, because it's dangerous and hot. And I went, yes. Okay.
Well, that'll allow us to cue into our next question. You're an international guy. You've lived around the world. You've spent some time in Havana, Cuba, in Montreal, Vancouver. And now you're in Taipei, Taiwan. Describe some cultural challenges that you might find in Taipei, because you're obviously Caucasian. What do you find that's interesting or different about Taipei that maybe stretches you a little bit in your ability to adapt to a different culture?
Well, you have to put it in context, because you also forgot to mention that I also lived in Europe for a while, in the Netherlands and in Germany, and I've spent probably, out of the last 15 years, 80 or 85% of that time outside of Canada. But when I first came to Asia and China, it was a little shocking for me, because all the stuff that I was accustomed to hearing about what China was like was totally different. And I kind of got used to it. And here in Taiwan is a lot easier, because Taiwan has a lot of Western influences. Unlike China, that during the Cultural Revolution, which lasted from the late 60s to probably the late 1970s, where they tried to get rid of anything Western, Taiwan has always embraced it. They've always embraced it. For a number of reasons. I mean, don't forget, from 1949 until 1976, Taiwan had diplomatic relations with the United States. The U.S. military had a military base here. So there's a big presence of American culture. There's a big presence of Japanese culture, because Taiwan was a colony of Japan for many years. And then also European culture, because one of the first countries to colonize Taiwan was the Netherlands, followed by Portugal and also Spain for a very short period of time. So Taiwan has had many influences from many different countries. So when I came to Taiwan, you know, it's very funny. Like, when I tell people that Taiwan has a cafe culture, they look at me oddly and go, huh? You know? But it does. And I'm not talking about, like, the big chains like Starbucks. I'm talking about, like, you know, the small little cafes that you'd find maybe, like, in Vancouver or Seattle or in Paris, you know? There's literally thousands of these throughout the city, where people go and have brunch on Sundays and, you know, the weekday after work, maybe go there for a coffee, sit around with friends, watch the world go by. And also, like, for example, even with food, unlike maybe China, which is totally different. Here in Taiwan, it's very easy to find Western food. I mean, there's a number of restaurants that have been opened by Taiwanese that, let's say, lived overseas and came back and said, oh, I'm going to open like a Australian type steakhouse or something, or a German restaurant. And there's also a lot of foreigners here as well that open up these restaurants. So culturally, it's very odd. You know, the people here in Taiwan have been influenced by so many different cultures that Taipei, and I speak of Taipei because if you go, of course, to the countryside, it's a little bit different. But Taipei and any of the other large cities here, like Kaohsiung or Taichung, is very international. If you come here and, let's say, you don't speak Chinese, finding people that do speak Chinese is very easy, because most people under the age of 40 or 45 speak some limited English. And, of course, the younger they get, under 30, they quite often speak it fluently. You know, so when I've had friends that have come to visit, they've never had a problem getting around, even with taxi drivers. Taxi drivers as well know some basic English. And culturally, it's different in that the Chinese aspect of it, Taiwan culture or Chinese culture in Taiwan is closer to original, the traditional Chinese culture than it is in China, because in China they had the influence of the Communist Party that had banned many books and changed the language and stuff like that. That never happened here. But yet in Taiwan, it's a very traditional culture from the Chinese aspect, they're very modern at the same time, and their way of thinking is very modern and very European and very outgoing and very very welcoming to new ideas, and very progressive. I mean, Taiwan in all of Asia was even noted in Newsweek magazine a few years ago to have some of the most progressive thinking in the rest of Asia, which in the rest of Asia, it's very conservative. If you take Singapore and Hong Kong, it's conservative because of maybe the British influence and all that. But, you know, Taiwan has evolved so much that people are very progressive here in their thinking, and they have very progressive policies, government policies, which don't exist anywhere else in Asia. So settling in here wasn't much of a culture shock at all. But I do have to say, what was a culture shock was the first time that I went back to Canada after being in Asia for a few years. It was different, and I can give you an example. Not too long ago, I was having a problem with a vacuum cleaner that I just bought, an expensive vacuum cleaner that was just out of warranty. And there was a problem with the filter. One of my dogs actually got hold of the filter and destroyed it. And I went, oh, damn, great. This is going to cost me money. So I brought the filter to the shop that I bought it, and I said, look, I know them. I have to get another filter. My dog destroyed it. And they said, I said, how much is it for you to get me a new one? And they made a phone call, and they said, oh, it'll take about 2 weeks to get. And the guy hung up the phone. He said, it takes about 2 weeks to get. And he went, oh, okay, order it. And then he said to me, oh, don't worry. He told one of his staff to go to the floor model, take it out of the floor model, and he just gave it to me. I didn't have to pay anything. And this is a major electronics chain here in Taiwan. For customer service, they're phenomenal, and they're known for that kind of service. But I remember when I went back to Canada and I had to return something, which was only like a day out of the 7-day period that I was returning it. And I only returned it because I was coming back to Asia. And I bought something for somebody, but they already had one. So it was only a day. And I went to the store, and it was. I said, look, I'm really sorry. I know it's a day out of warranty, but, you know, I'm leaving back to Asia tomorrow, and I bought this by mistake. Can I exchange it? I have the receipt. It has not been opened. And all they said is, well, we can give you a credit. I said, well, I don't. There's nothing else that you have here that I want. I said, I just want to return it. Oh, we can't do that. And it was just a big song and dance. You know, it was just a big song and dance. And even like just recently, last month with my internet bill, for some reason I didn't get it. And I was cut off, and I was saying, oh, this is strange. I didn't get the bill sent to me. And I contacted the company, and I said, look, can you resend the bill? Because I didn't get it yet. And they said, oh, okay, we'll send it out tomorrow. And I said, well, I need to use it tonight. And they said, oh, well, it's okay. They said, you'll get the bill tomorrow. We'll just reconnect you right now. And that was it. No argument. Now, what surprised me was the next day, they didn't send it by mail. No, they didn't send it by mail. The guy I'd spoken to on the phone in the customer service department from Xindian, which is only about 10 minutes away, 15 minutes away, drove on his scooter the next day at 9 o'clock in the morning with the bill in hand and said, oh, we're sorry that you didn't get it. It was a mistake on our part. I was shocked. Bowling. I was so surprised.
5-0. We're going to end off with a song, A Little Help from My Friends. See you next time, friends.
This has been a special edition of Music Without Borders. Special thanks goes to Apple Corporation, EMI, Abbey Road Studios, Ricochet, BBC Radio 1, and the Beatles International Fan Club. The program was produced and presented by Keith Perron. I'm John Kennedy.
What would you think if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing.
Well, speaking of dogs eating vacuum cleaners, the canine component factors pretty heavily in the life of Keith Perron. Where did that begin? Is this a childhood thing? I know you're involved in pet rescue, so let's talk a little bit about that for a moment.
The pet rescue, yeah. That started That started by accident. There's a group here in Taiwan called Animals Taiwan, which is a rescue. But it's a different rescue from, let's say, the SPCA or others. They rescue dogs that have either been hit by cars, that have been caught in jing traps and other devices, or have been abused by owners. They will take dogs that other shelters or rescues will not take. Excuse me. They will take dogs that other shelters and other rescues organizations will not take. And I came across them because I was asked by a station in Hong Kong that contacted me, a TV station. They said, can you do a small 15-minute feature about this animal rescue? And I said, yeah, sure. And so I went there and did it, and I found it extremely interesting because something that Animals Taiwan does is they have a policy to never, never put an animal down under any circumstances. So if you go to the Resco, it's quite unique because there are dogs that have two legs that walk with wheelchairs, and they find homes for them. You know, and they'll say, look, the dog is only 4 years old. He still has a lot of life. Okay, he uses a wheelchair, but, you know, there's people that use wheelchairs as well. Of course, if you have this kind of dog, it's a very, it takes somebody very special to be able to look after this kind of animal because it's a lot more work. But it is quite amazing because these dogs that were hit by cars have lost the use of their hind legs. Running and playing with the other dogs in a wheelchair. They bring them down to the beach. They take the wheelchair off of them. The dog will pull himself with his front leg, get in the water, and swim. You know, it is quite unique. And they have some other dogs that have, say, three legs missing, either a front leg or hind leg. Some dogs that are blind. Dogs that are very old. And the dogs that are old, because it's as you know, Colin, it's difficult to find homes for old dogs, right? But they actually built a dog sanctuary. So the older dogs that, let's say, have arthritis, for example, or are blind or can't walk anymore, they're put in the animal sanctuary. They're taken care of, and they just die when it's time for them to die. And there's one dog there, a German Shepherd, that they picked up about 4 years ago at a bus shelter. The dog was probably at some point a security dog that they decided to like let loose, which was very irresponsible, and the dog had been living off the street. He has arthritis. He can't walk anymore. He's half blind. He has no teeth. And most of the day he just sits there, but when it's time to go to the bathroom, he can do that. It takes him a while to stand up, but he doesn't walk much or walk at all. But you know, a few times a week, they load him into the truck, they bring him down to the beach, they put him in the water, and he swims. And it is quite amazing. So I decided to get involved with them, and what I have been doing for them is to produce videos for their website for the dogs that they want adopted. There's a lot of dogs that are it's very sad when you look at them because there's some dogs that they have not been socialized, meaning they had been living on the street since they were born. They don't know, they don't know how to interact with humans. They're very violent. And I have three dogs that at the rescue that I'm supporting financially every month that need to be socialized. And two times a week I go and I try to get a little closer to them. And I mean, I've been bitten countless times there by a number of dogs. But, you know, it's the thing. The guy who began Animals Taiwan, he said, you know, if a dog bites you, the worst thing you can do is run away. If you stick up to him and show him who's boss and everything, he will get submissive. But, you know, dogs will sense fear. If they fear that somebody's afraid of them, of course they're going to act violent, you know? So, I mean, I've been bitten a number of times. One dog, Nanook, I mean, he grabbed me on the knee and he wouldn't let go until I smacked him I smacked him hard. And ever since that time, he has been so friendly to me, you know? So I'm not afraid of getting bitten by dogs and stuff. But it's amazing work that they do. So I do these videos. We do maybe 4, 5, 6 videos a month. And people can go to the website and they can see the dog, you know, interacting with other dogs, playing, swimming, and doing whatever else dogs do. And then come by the rescue and adopt him.
That was one of my favorite art big band, the Skymaster, one of Holland's best big bands with I'm Old Fashioned. I can hear the logger alarm going in the background. Coming up next is the Ritz of comedy shows with Beta Wayne.
I'm going to move along to a couple of concluding questions, maybe a little bit about the future and the present. You've done a lot of celebrity interviews in your history. You've done a lot of interviews with interesting people on PCJ and Happy Station. So my question is, living or dead, a few persons that Keith Perrone would love to interview, living or dead?
Living. Well, let's begin with dead first.
That might be easier.
Dead. Well, I'll tell you, top of the list would be Peter Sellers. Second on the list is another comedian. Actually, I know some people are going to cringe when I say his name, but it would actually be Benny Hill. Who else would I want to interview? Actually, I would love to interview somebody like Pierre Trudeau, former Canadian Prime Minister. That, I think, would be fascinating. Somebody else, past, maybe Richard Burton. I think would be interesting.
People, I'd have a couple of questions for him.
You know, people that are alive. That's an odd one because there's people who are alive. I would like to interview Sir Paul McCartney. Definitely Sir Paul McCartney. But I would not do an interview about the Beatles or Wings. I would not do an interview about that. I would want to interview him about the music that he has been doing in maybe the last 10 years, which is classical music. Interview him about that, and also interview him about some film scores that he did. Other people that I would love to interview, I would like to interview, and this will seem very strange to some people, but I would like to interview, of all people, the former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. I don't know why. I think he seems interesting. You know, I mean, it's different. Like when there's people that I want to interview, I like to interview them because I find them interesting. It's not really about maybe their personality, but more about what they have done. Now, the reason why I mentioned Benny Hill, for example, people have underestimated the contribution to what he actually did for television. Now, people that are listening to this in North America will not understand what I mean by that. But if you had seen shows that he did that were not seen in, that were not part of the regular Benny Hill show that people got in syndication in North America, then you would understand why. You know, because a lot of the material that was sent for the overseas market was really the bottom of the barrel stuff compared to the stuff that was being shown in the UK and in some other markets. And Peter Sellers, only because I am a huge Peter Sellers fan, and there's certain aspects of comedy that he did that has in some ways influence my sense of humor. And the fact that, I mean, Peter Sellers was mad. I mean, he was insane, you know? But something as well, people have underestimated him. He was also a fine actor. And there's a clear example of that. The last film that he did called Being There with Shirley MacLaine is a dramatic comedy. But he is so good in that role that many film critics have said that, you know, he should have done more of these kind of films. But, you know, he was, I think, maybe too mad, and he wanted to make a lot of money. So, you know, he'd do some, like, you know, silly Pink Panther movies, which I'm not a big fan of the Pink Panther movies. I'm more a fan of, like, films like Being There, which was really good. You know, and maybe for a silly movie like The Party, you know, where he's playing an Indian actor who just gets stuck in Hollywood and is just like totally bewildered by the strange acting characters in Hollywood, you know.
Mm-hmm. Final, you know, question.
Another. I'd like to add one more, but there is one more actor that I would love to interview. Unfortunately, he died recently, and that is Patrick McGoohan. Does that name ring a bell, Colin?
Yes.
You know, Patrick McGoohan, who did The Prisoner.
Yeah.
And only because Danger Man and The Prisoner are two of my all-time favorite shows. And Patrick McGoohan, I mean, he was an enigma. I mean, he was very strange, very odd, very eccentric. And people that had met him and had worked with him, they said, you know, they loved working with him, but they said he was very unpredictable. You never knew what he would do. And, you know, they said a clear example of that, they said, would be The Prisoner. They said The Prisoner was Patrick's idea from the beginning. He wrote it, he directed many episodes, he was in charge completely of the production.
So, Happy Station's been re-germinated in the year 2009, 2010. We've got a modest audience. PCJ Media building a catalog of multimedia. Where do you see Happy Station and PCJ Media in 5 years?
Well, my plan from the onset was to do something a little different. I mean, when I came up with the idea to do Happy Station, initially the idea was as a one-off special. But because of the response that I had, I was like, well, okay, a show every 2 weeks. And then it became weekly. The plan that I had at the beginning was, this is long-term. You need to build an audience. And it has to be done over time. I mean, there's two ways of doing it. Either you go into it with guns blazing and try to get as big an audience right away, which could be a little bit unstable, or you can use the approach what I want to use, which is you build it slowly, you get people who are loyal, and then you get new listeners, and then all of a sudden they remain, you know, they stay as loyal listeners, and so on and so on. So this is definitely a long-term thing for me. It wasn't something that I thought, okay, well, you know, have a little fun with it and that's it. It's sort of become like a second job, something that I'm very passionate about. You know, when I'm not working at Central Radio here in Taiwan, I'm spending all my time on PCJ and trying to think new things and stuff. So it is definitely, it is a long-term plan. And one of the things that was important to me was if I listened to the shows, let's say I did at the beginning, say, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, the early, you know, at the beginning in 2009, and how much the show has changed a lot since then. Because when I started the show, the last thing that I didn't want to do, because I knew that a lot of the people maybe that had listened to Tom Meyer and Eddie Starts and Pete Myers and Jonathan Goubert would be tuning in now, which they did and they have. But I didn't want to become too different, because there were some people that were, I remember some comments on some DX blog, they were saying, you know, oh, it's probably going to come along and play like hard rock and Leonard Cohen music, and it's going to be, it's not going to be like Happy Station at all. So at the beginning, I tried to stay as close to the original Happy Station from the Tom Meyer era. And then over time, start making changes. Now, I'm making the changes within keeping it what the show stood for. I mean, I know that sounds may sound a little odd, but I look at Happy Station not just as a radio show, but as it was an idea. It was an idea that Eddie Starts had, and it creates a certain tone, and trying to keep with that. Some people have criticized me for saying, "Oh, you play too much music on the show," and then when I do too much talk, they say, "Oh, you talk too much. You're not playing enough music." And it's funny. I remember the one, and I'm not going to mention any names, but there's this one person who listens who actually wrote in one time and said, "Keith, you play too much music on the show. I tune out after 5 minutes." And I went, "Okay." And then a few weeks later, we had a show where I had like 3 or 4 interviews. He wrote back again and said, "Keith, there was too much talk this time. There was almost no music. I tuned it after a few minutes." And I went, "Well, this guy's only tuning in for a few minutes anyway. It doesn't make any difference."
You can't please anybody.
You can't please anybody. So now I'm sort of mixing it. We've been doing quite a few interviews on the show. We have some more coming up. But I am going to do some of the music specials. This past week, we talked about the vinyl market here in Asia, and we played some very unusual vinyl recordings with an interview with a guy who manages one of the biggest vinyl suppliers here in Taiwan. And a listener that we have in the UK by the name of Philip Jackson. Hello, Philip, who lives, I believe, just outside of London. We were talking on Facebook a while ago, and I don't know how it came up, but we were talking about like weird novelty songs, which were very popular in the UK at the time. And Philip's a young guy. And he said, it'd be funny if you did a show on like weird novelty songs that came from Britain, and it's things like you have like a national newsreader doing a song, or, Margaret Thatcher singing Red Roses for a Blue Lady, which she actually did, by the way. that's a future show. But now it's, like I said, I'm taking it one step at a time, taking it in baby steps, and I think it's the way to go. I like doing things slowly, and I like doing it slowly only because I've seen, and you've seen as well in the past, people will come up with something, and they go into it guns blazing, bang, 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 and then like 2 years later, it's disappeared. So I want to take it slow, and I want to take it easy. And again, I think it's like I said, it's building an audience, and building an audience can happen overnight. And I don't want it to happen overnight because I still want to be, at the stage now where, we could still do things and change things and experiment with things that don't push away the audience. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense, Colin?
Absolutely.
So now it's a good time to experiment and do some tweaking and play with this idea, play with that idea, and to do stuff. Because if once you get to a certain level, you can't you can't really do that anymore. That's where the plan is for the next 5 years. But I love it. I'm having a great time.
Well, Keith Perrone in Taipei, Taiwan. Thanks for your time. Your interviewer has been, of course, Colin Newell with PCJ Media and DXR.ca website. Thanks for the interview.
On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are. How it will astound you that the glow of your being outshines every star. You'll feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore. You can hear from far and near a world you've never ever heard before. And on that clear day, on that clear day, you will see forever and evermore. You feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore. You can hear from far and near a world you've never ever heard before. That clear day,
that clear day, you will see for